This is tape two with Ann Farrer Willett, October 29th, 1996. Mae Warren doing the interview.
You had just asked me about the children growing up, and I was saying it was almost idyllic, and it was. It was a simpler time, and that part of it was wonderful. But I do remember the years they were students at WNL, and they were a bit, at times that was a bit of a challenge, because the last thing I wanted to be was a hovering mother. And so the boys, of course, as freshmen, lived in the dorm. And then they lived at the SAE house their sophomore year. And then they branched out as students were beginning to do then, and with groups of friends had places in the country, you know how they do, and commute. And I tend to be sometimes rather outspoken when I'm aroused. Student behavior was one of the hot spots. And Jimmy may have even told you about a student yelling once, and I immediately marched up to WNL, reported this vile language that I had heard. I have to laugh now, which is nothing compared to what we just take in stride now. And that boy apologized and apologized, but I remember I was going on, I was in a hurry, and had the gal, the old lady really, who helped me sometimes. She was in the car with me. She almost had heart failure. As we came into Main Street, a car, Washington Lee group of students were just flying down Main. They were on the way out to Zalman's Pavilion. And he just flew down the street, right, I guess it's Shenandoah Road. But anyway, all of a sudden, to my horror, a grapefruit landed right in the middle of my windshield. And went splat, and this poor woman screamed. That my passenger was terrified, and I was just—it's a wonder I didn't have an accident. Just kind of went flying on by, and I just saw red. It was as if it were my own boys, and for all I knew, one of them in the car very well could have been. But I turned that car around on a dime, and I'll find out who did this, and followed this car out there, only to find that the police had gotten him before I got there. And I looked, and there it was, Jimmy's best friends, the boys from the SAE house, who were equally horrified to see me, and that it was my car that they had thrown the grapefruit out and hit. Well, he's still apologizing some 20 years later.
Good for him. But he learned a lesson.
I learned to be a little more careful, because I sort of put blinders on, because for all I knew, it was when my own sons could very well have heaved the grapefruit. But they were fun years. We really enjoyed them, because their friends and their friends' parents became close friends. And of course, they were the years when the lacrosse team was...
You had quite a star there.
Hot stuff. And we just had this wonderful group, parents who went to every game and became, as I just said, very close. We had a big party on Parents Weekend on the Friday night. Always after the, there would be a reception in the dining hall. And the only time we could squeeze in a party would be after that at our house. And so many alumni were so gracious to Jim, and he would want to entertain them, because in his travels when he was recruiting, often he would stay with some of these guys. And so it was really a great, huge addition to our lives, where they have the boys, and they were so happy at WNL, and wonderful experiences for them. Jimmy played football, and I can remember saying, "Well, Jimmy, wouldn't you like to have some of the boys, you know, have them come out for supper Friday night or whatever?" He'd say, "Yeah." Of course, his boys that age are very casual, and I'd say, "Well, just tell me, how many do you think?" He said, "Oh, I don't know, maybe 40. Oh, maybe, I don't know, maybe 10. I mean, and you want to be with it. So I would just say, "Oh,
cool.
Okay, sure." And I'd just go with the flow. And Thanksgiving, there would always be a few boys who didn't go home for one reason or another, you know, the press of a term paper or something. So we always have four or five boys there, friends of Jimmy's and Scotty's. And, of course, we would have the turkey and all of that. And then I'd feel that I'd no sooner cleaned up the kitchen. Of course, they would immediately take their plates and rush to see the football game. There was always big games all day. And they would all be in front of the TV all day. And then before I could recover from lunch, you know, the boys would say, "Mom, isn't there any turkey for a sandwich?" So it would be that all day. But I wouldn't take anything in the world for the relationship we had with those boys. It's a big part of our lives. And then, as I think I've said to you, Scotty's junior year, he came home. I was upstairs, and I heard this. I said, "Mom," I said, "God, does he need money again?" You know, that was the only time they were home, with that dirty laundry or what. I went down and said, "Hi," and he said, "Hi, it's okay if I go to school in Hong Kong next year." "Once again, you don't want to do what?" I can remember that conversation with me saying, "Well, I don't know. Let's talk to your father when he comes home." Long enough to give myself a chance to recover. Of course, he did go and had was very maturing. He was lonely, I think, a good bit of the time. Every once in a while, I think after a few beers, some of his SAE buddies would call him from the other side of the world and, of course, harass him and tell him they were on their way to Highlands and just wanted to tell him, hope he was having fun at Chung Chi. So we had varied experiences and on the whole, very, very happy times.
Well, let's talk about happy times that are uniquely Washington and Lee happy times. Fancy dress.
Fancy dress.
You've probably been to more fancy dresses than almost anybody.
Ah!
Did you go year after year?
Oh, yeah.
I'm working on catching up with you. I've never planned to miss a fancy dress.
I've got a picture, I think, for you, a fancy dress of 53, maybe. Now, you were asking me if I had pictures, and we never could remember to take the camera or whatever, and we didn't have Pat Hinesley photographing everything. That just wasn't done in those days, unfortunately. But, yes, fancy dress comes to mind. They were always fun, and Jim was known in those years as the boy dean because he, you know, there were still students in school, and you know, and you realize this was a mixed up post-war crowd. There were, you found yourself in class with students, your classmates were some much younger and some older. Bob Huntley, for example, he wasn't in the service. He was a freshman, I guess, as I remember it. When we came back, Jim having graduated in 49, Bob was a freshman, a sophomore at the Deltas. They were fraternity brothers. But there was this age span difference.
And did you come to fancy dress as a student from mm-hmm. Randolph-Macon?
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's talk about that first.
Well, the first time I came, I was a senior in high school, and my father was dead set against it, not to mention my mother, that I was too young to go to a college dance. This would have been like in February of my senior year. Well, the boy who had invited me was a freshman. This would have been 43. So, you know, the boys hadn't even left en masse for service. He was too young. He was my age. I guess I was 16 and he was 18, I suppose. Well, after much, he was a friend, a W&L friend of a friend, a boy I'd grown up with and gone to school with a year ahead of me, and he was now a freshman. And so this friend of his had invited me to come, and my parents were saying, "Certainly not," and I was begging and pleading and everything, dying to go, of course. And my mother had, when she had come to Washington Lee and BMI dances in her youth, had stayed at Miss Lizzie Graham's. Miss Lizzie ran that, you know, took student dates. And she lived over right near the BMI gates. So finally, it was decided All right, if you can stay at Miss Lizzie Graham's, you may go. Well, as it turned out, what they didn't know was that by then, Miss Lizzie was very old. She had lost most of her sight. She had no idea who came and went when. She no longer ruled and sat in her parlor and checked the girls in, I guess. And so I just had a marvelous time, and it was quite unlike going to a high school dance in Lynchburg. And I'll never forget walking into the ATO house, which was this boys' fraternity. In those days, it's now Seven Hills. It was a very handsome fraternity house. And I remember walking in, and I was just gaga. I mean, I knew I was so green. I knew I didn't belong there, and I was so unsophisticated, trying to be very cool. And I remember we walked into the hall, and there was nobody. There were no students around in the living room, and somebody said, "Oh, go on up. Everybody's upstairs." And I just nearly fainted. I thought, upstairs? You know, having been told, I'm sure, by my mother and my father that I was to do this and not do that and whatever. Well, it turned out that, of course, I became quite accustomed to that. I mean, what they were doing, they had a big galvanized tub in the middle of the hall upstairs, and they were all had beer in there, and they were all just partying, and, you know, everything was perfectly safe and they were house mothers, so everything was just as it should be. But it was an eye-opener to me. That was my first, and this boy was so nice, and he knew my parents, so he, told he did his serious partying after he had dropped me off at Miss Lizzie Graham's. But then I went off to college after that, and you know the funny wrinkle there is that then I met Frank at Georgia Tech, and life at Georgia Tech was much like life at Washington and Lee. So for those 2 years, that's where I was. And then came back to Randolph-Macon my junior year, because my family had close Randolph-Macon ties, mm-hmm. and wanted their two daughters to graduate there. And in those days, it was much more transferring than there is now, I suspect. So it had been decided that Agnes Scott would be very good preparation, and I would get a good basis and come back, good base, and come back to Randolph-Macon, which I did. And then that was different, because it was, all the boys then were coming back after the war. It was crazy mixed up. These were vets then. You know, they'd fought in the Battle of the Bulge and all kinds of things. So now they're back in school. And it was a little poignant, because some didn't come back. But we had a great time. All my friends in Lynchburg, girls I'd grown up with, we were just having a marvelous time, because everybody we knew suddenly was back. And there was gas then. We could all drive then over, come over to W&L or VMI, as the case were. And there were lots of, and boys trying to, many of them, make up for lost time. So it was a loose, happy time. And faculty, I think, in both places were understanding. You know, at VMI in particular, it was pretty hard to keep a boy locked up in barracks when he landed at Anzio. So it was an interesting time. I really hadn't thought, I can remember some disabilities as a result of the war among these young boys.
Did you go to fancy dress the bicentennial year?
Oh yeah.
1949?
Yes, Jim invited me. I came to fancy dress with him, yeah. And I'm trying to remember whether we dressed up. I came to fancy dress, and it's funny, I don't remember. I remember distinctly coming a couple of years later when we came back. So that would have been 49, we were married in 50, and then by 52 or 3 we were back. And I remember that more vividly. I really don't remember fancy dress of 49 too well. I remember going up, the faculty chaperoned. I remember going up to speak to the Gillums. And that's what, but I don't remember much about the, and I remember there was a party that night. People used to go watch the sunrise over on the footbridge. Remember that? I don't know why I don't remember the dance that night, the ball, as clearly. I remember things going on around it, and I remember going and watching the sunrise, and the band, part of the band, used their combo from whoever the orchestra had played for the dance, would go, and they would just, you know, they're just a jazz session kind of thing down at the end of the far end of the footbridge toward the stadium. And lots of people would straggle on over, and it was fun. You know, everybody thought it was daring to stay up all night and watch the sun come up over there and the band playing. I don't know, maybe they still do that. Because fancy dress is now big time. But it was...
Well, hasn't it always been
it was
big
the social
time?
Event of the South, yeah. And it pleases me to see, and they really get into it and the decorations and all of that. Of course, the gym, the old gym was not exactly the most elegant place in the world, but it certainly served its purpose. And as a matter of fact, I think 49 may have been the year of the blizzard. You check the records, one of the fancy dress years, and it may have been that one. I don't think it was canceled, but there was a huge blizzard because I can remember my friends at Randolph Macon, everybody wringing their hands whether we were going to get over the mountain.
Oh, wow, that would be.
Oh, it was a crisis, major crisis. Maybe that's why I have just a vague recollection of the ball, but anyway, you look it up. And
I will. I didn't know that.
And I will dig out that picture of 53. I remember we were all dressed up. White tie, I think, maybe. Jim has white tie and tails.
Oh,
but
I must
anyway,
see that.
Yeah.
I must see that.
Anyway.
Well, so through the years, how did fancy dress change?
Well, I think we went and went. We probably got burned out. I mean, we went and went and went to everything. And now when I see Kitty, my daughter-in-law, whom you know, struggling to balance everything, and particularly with Jimmy responsible for a lot of what's going on. But it was just expected. It was not only, we saw it sort of as our duty, really. There was no resentment of the fact that, gosh, I ought to be getting paid for this. I must say, I enjoyed it. I didn't feel put upon that I was supposed to be there or be in a receiving line or be doing something, helping. There wasn't any of that. It was just part of our life. And it was, I guess, too, you have to enjoy all these people. And Jim knew them all and thoroughly enjoyed them. And at that time, some of them had known his father. So it was a... And back to what I said earlier, I always enjoyed the fact that we're all different ages. And I think we would have missed a lot if your life is just going, go to work and go home, go to work and go home. So it was quite a, we thought we were really lucky.
I thought the most charming thing about fancy dress was that socializing, getting all dressed up and going and socializing with people of all ages and all status.
Oh,
and I have good friends in Buildings and Grounds, and there they all were all dressed
well,
up.
Now
and
you,
that was
well,
wonderful.
Now Buildings and Grounds is something that went through my head a while ago. I think I alluded to them once, and I thought briefly, just I want to come back to tell you. Have you had that? You obviously have had the opportunity now to, and you have been sensitive to the fact that Buildings and Grounds, we call it, the Buildings and Grounds, were such a valued part of the Washington and Lee family.
Talk about that.
Oh, Jim thought the Buildings and Grounds guys were it. He would no more have overlooked one of these guys or asked them to do anything that would be an imposition. He thought the they made the place work. And of course, he was right. And I mean, he wasn't the only one who felt that way. Mm-hmm. Have you had the opportunity to see all Buildings Grounds always came to graduation? I mean, they not only put up all the chairs and did all of that, but they stayed and thoroughly enjoyed it. It has been, and I say this not in a light way of we and them or us and, you know, I just can't tell you the affection and respect. I keep saying that Jim felt, well, that was because, of course, that was my experience, but everybody had that feeling.
There isn't much us and them at Washington and Lee.
No, no. And when there was that recent flap, I was just aghast, and I thought, oh, thank God Jim is spared this. And had it become a greater flap than it did, I mean, it just would have devastated him and many others who over the years had felt that way. And I know from my own son's attitude that it's still there.
Oh, very much so.
You've,
I think that was a quirk that happened.
Yeah, yeah, it was not typical. It was not typical at all of W&L. Something we just said, I meant to talk about, to come back to, I've forgotten, I'll think of it in a minute, along those same lines. But yes, people all got dressed up and went.
And everybody just parties together and has a great time.
Yeah. I think the Christmas party at W, that's an innovation that has come since our time. I guess I was about to say the time did come when it got a little old. You know, you do get to the point you think, oh. I can't say that in later years we went to every single one of them. And then our children, too, as they came along, I didn't really want to be looking over their shoulders all the time. So we kind of didn't do quite as much, I guess, as we did when we were much younger. But the mock conventions, you know, were a part of our lives.
That's my next question. Tell me about mock conventions.
Oh, gosh, it was like this. I sensed from the little I saw here on CNN that everybody went. We went to everything. I mean, I remember Jim had what he called Sports Central at our house, where he framed all these athletic pictures of not just of our children, but of his good buddies, certain students. The news office would give him these prints, football shots, lacrosse, and all that. And he stuck them up in our utility room, which he called Sports Central. And to this day, some of those guys will ask me, say, what did you ever do with Sports Central? You know, it's still in boxes, probably at Jimmy's house. And among that were letters from, like, Richard Nixon thanking Jim, because his advance guys would come, and anybody who was coming, just not just Nixon, but any of the big speakers. And as a matter of fact, we were standing in the balcony of the old gym when Alvin Barkley dropped dead. I was standing right across, looking right down at him, right directly across from him. And it, you know, again, everybody went to everything. And who took that picture? Wasn't Frank. Frank Parsons did. I'll think after a while who may or may not remember. But it's John Jennings. John Jennings took it. Now in journalism, he was a student, and he had his camera, and clicked it. And Life bought it, I think, or something. Anyway,
what's the picture?
Alvin Barkley, you know, dropped dead.
Yes,
and right there on the podium, and he was just had just finished saying, "I'd rather." What's the verse from the Bible? Then sit in this seat of the mighty. And with that, he dropped dead.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember Jim turning to me and saying, quick, we've got to, I'll get the car. We'll need to, I'll go down and see if we can take Ms. Barkley over to the hospital or something. And I remember thinking, oh, my Lord. I remember I had then, I don't think I had three, I had two young children. The car was just full of junk and all the children's gear. And there was hardly any place to, I remember we got Mrs. Barkley in the car, and he roared off and left me standing on the sidewalk, which was fine. That was more appropriate. But you couldn't. I had all the mess that you have when you've got children in the back of a station wagon. But we didn't miss much, you know. And when I think back, and the letters, the children would get a kick out of the letters being from Goldwater and thanking Jim for maybe having picked them up in Roanoke at the airport, because there wasn't. I mean, everybody pitched in. Again, I'd forgotten about that. You just did what somebody said, Jim, could you pick up so-and-so? It was just that kind of life. It wasn't as structured as it is now. We didn't have student helpers. What's the group that...
Catholic.
Yeah. All of them came through, all of the political figures. Contact was just starting in those years. When Goldwater spoke, and we all thought Goldwater was the boogeyman. If you've read the newspapers, you thought he was going to hit the button and blow up the world. Just as there were William Faulkner and, what's the very distinguished black writer? He was the first, as far as I know, and you could check me on this, Frank would know, first black speaker maybe in Lee Chapel. He wrote the Who wrote the Invisible
Ralph
Man?
Ellison.
Yeah, if you check with Frank, I think it was Ralph Ellison. I wouldn't want to be held to that, but I remember he was probably the first. Could that be? But I think it may have been.
I don't know the answer to that.
Well, you see, again, Jim told you everything he said, but all these people came through. And. And there we were, sitting there. Some benefited more than others. I'm a good example. I didn't benefit as much as I should. So I can't remember it all, but I think it might have been Ellison. Speaking to this audience, you know, who was shocked that they were sitting there listening. I remember when Duke Ellington came, it happened to be at BMI, and I was introduced to him. And I didn't know whether to shake hands with him or not. This would have been in 51. I didn't quite know how to. I did. But I remember going thinking, what did I do? These were. And I've often wondered where they stayed. I suppose after that gig, after they played any of the black musicians, they just moved on. Because there's certainly no place for them to stay in Lexington.
That's an excellent question. That's an excellent question.
Unless they stay there. You know, we had a wonderful black community. And again, the black community in Lexington was much a part of university life because there were so many who worked buildings and grounds. And I mean, their jobs were certainly menial, but when you look at it from another point of view, they were permanent jobs and worked for, as Jim would say, first class people. And there was a warm relationship. I think I could really say in all honesty, because we had many black friends. And when Jim died, John Elrod said to me after his funeral, he said, I couldn't believe how many black people were there. You've got to remember that Jim remembered his barber cut his hair when he was a student. And he was devastated by his death. And then he became a houseboy at the Delt House. I guess he did both. He learned to barber and he was... So little changed in a little town like... And I'm going to use the word I'm hesitant to use, but perhaps Lexington was unique in that way. I mean, how do I know? That was only my experience. I can't say it was really unique, but certainly there were not many communities like that. The academic, do you think it would be that? Because the only two games in town were academic, there was more... a collegial feeling? I don't know.
Are there any particular people in the Black community whom you think would be good to interview?
I'm sure there are, and so many whom I knew well are gone now. But I mean, the ones that rush to my mind. But yes, and I'll think about that, and my son Jimmy will know exactly the answer to that. Yes, as a matter of fact, Napoleon.
I've got him on my list.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Yeah.
I've already talked to him.
He comes to mind, and Jimmy would be able to tell you whether there are any others.
Any women?
Of course, Dolly, his wife, but those who worked, the one who I wish you could have talked to is gone. She worked for people in town, but she cleaned W&L offices at 4 o'clock in the morning before she... Mm. So there were people like that. There may still be, I don't know whether Paige, she was a woman who did a lot of parties. I'd have to find out. I don't know whether she's still there. Still living, that is.
Let's talk about co-education.
Yeah. Well, you know that Davidson co-educated 10 years before we did. It was a tremendous problem to my husband, who knew it had to happen. I mean, remember, this is his university that he loved more than anything in the world, and he did not want change for the sake of change. There was no gimmick. But there were those, again, this conservative board, who thought that, oh, it's just a passing fad, co-education. And again, the old argument, General Lee's college, how could we possibly have women? He would never have done that. Well, so he will remember, he was interviewing, going to high school nights, going to secondary schools, everywhere. And he would come back and tell me how students would stop and want to talk about Washington and Lee. If this was a big gathering as high schools had and still have, I guess, college night kinds of things. And they would look at the literature and then say, oh, male, forget it, and move on. Meantime, Davidson and others were interviewing, accepting women, and accepting male students who wanted co-education. Now, whenever an applicant, he tracked applicants over the years. If an applicant was offered admission and declined, he always followed up with a questionnaire asking them to please let us know, why did you choose not to come to W&L? And over, their overriding reasons were, well, three come to mind, I think, that were predominant. One was, I have two brothers. My father can't afford to send me. I'm going to UVA, state school. Second was, often, I want an urban. I've decided I don't want to, you know, Lexington. I want to go to school near a big city. And then, of course, oh, there was the, I want a co-educated, I want co-education. I don't want an all-male school. Now, there are young men Jimmy's age right here on this mountain, alumni, who tell me, well, you know, it was ruined. They're most critical of the co-education and of the John Wilson's courageous decision to improve the fraternity houses. And I'm thinking of one young man here who's, well, he's in his 40s now, he's a young man to me. And I just can't believe he's still objecting. It may be that he just doesn't want to send money, I don't know. But he's objecting still to those two things. But anyway, the co-education, of course, was just critical. And it was so hard to get alumni to understand. And poor John Wilson. The abuse. It was one of the happiest days of Jim's life when the board made that decision. As close as it was, the vote was, he felt that W&L was at the crossroads and that its excellence was become constantly weaker And of course, Alumni didn't want to hear that because we could still fill the beds. And they would say, we don't need it. Well, you know, you could fill the beds, but you certainly could not be selective. And the faculty, our pride and joy, the jewel of Washington Lee is this marvelous faculty we've always had. Well, they could stay around and just educate. They'd be gone. So it was a tough, boy, feelings ran high.
Tell me about that day. Where were you the day of the decision?
No, we were just waiting. And as soon, I can't remember who called. It may have come over the radio. We jumped right in the car, Jim, and went right straight to the president's house to embrace John Wilson and congratulate him.
Did you go to
it? Yeah.
Tell me about that.
Oh,
describe it to me.
So emotional, right in the driveway. You can imagine John just drained. Though Ann always said he has a tough hide, but it had to have been. And then, of course, the abuse poured in, that he wanted to change it. He did it underhanded way. Of course he didn't. And, nothing succeeds like success, and it gradually subsided, and then all of a sudden, the most violently opposed alumnus is writing about his darling daughter. So, it took a while, but it was, as I say, a very emotional time. And we just happened to have been just thrilled to death because it was better for the university. And the difference immediately, because of course the girls, that first group of girls had they had such guts, first of all, and they were a very interesting, I'm sure you've talked to some of them.
Tell me about them.
And there's one I'd like to tell you about that you would enjoy talking to. Because it was she who pointed out to me that they were such a different group. They weren't your typical. They didn't have the kind of relation. I think what she said, as I remember it now, I hadn't thought about it in so long. She was telling me that dorm life, it wasn't just a bunch of buddies living together. They all were very different, and they were chosen because they were different. They had a strong bond because they were the first crowd, but they weren't all warm and fuzzy, as I think she put it, together. They were different. And there were some who were athletic, and some who were musical, and some who were this, and some who were that. But they, of course, took tremendous pride in the fact that they were the first class. But Washington Lee students, particularly, I think in that, the only thing I can say in defense of the boys who were seniors and who had heard all of this going on most of their college career, you know, are we or aren't we? The class, I forget now, the class of 84 maybe, anyway, the senior, you know, work over and over was said that the quality of the student body was not as good as it had been. And I think Bill Hartog would tell you right now that it still, in spite of all of this success, has not reached the level of, I think it was the class, he has paid many tributes to the quality of the class of along 64, 65. You know a lot of them, Buck Ogilvy. A lot of those guys who've come through, I can hardly speak of him right now without emotion. He just died. I'll come back to it in a minute. I know it just as well as I know my own name. Mason knew. He was part of that era. He is a trustee who just died a few weeks ago in Richmond. These men now, I don't think anybody would question. They were the strongest. Many of them played football on that Lee McLaughlin team that was number one in the country in small colleges. it was just a real high point, high watermark in quality in every way. And then it began, for the reasons I just gave, to slowly, slowly, slowly drop off. If it were your livelihood and you were in charge, you saw it and were very sensitive to it. But if you didn't understand it and were able to see that we still had large numbers applying, you weren't seeing that the quality was gradually eroding. And that was what was hard to sell. So that class of young men who were in those last classes in the 80s, just before the first women came in, probably were very self-conscious and felt they'd been abused and run down, you know, as if they were dummies. And of course they weren't, but it wasn't, certainly wasn't a class that you could compare to those classes at our high watermark in the 60s, early 70s. So the girls had to then take a lot of that resentment. You know, there were T-shirts that really were crude. It was a tough time, but they survived, and more, girls were. And I remember our friends, our colleagues and friends on the faculty who talked about the difference in the demeanor of the students. Like it or not, these were bright girls who were brought in, and they were a big-time challenge. Those who had been admitted and as they came. Big-time challenge to the boys. But Jim used to get such a kick out of seeing them all sitting in the co-op, good friends, sitting there talking about class and that kind of camaraderie, which he felt was so healthy and so to be desired, so much better given the changes in society and you know, the need for them to go to school together, because they were going to have to work together. So it was, from our point of view, extremely exciting. And then when Episcopal High School co-educated some years later, he said, just watch, it's going to be a mirror image, because it was a small, all-male, high-quality academically, and it has been. It's just been a mirror image. Their student body has gotten a lot larger. And I don't think anybody has really wanted our student body. I've never heard anybody say they wanted it to double or become quite large. And I feel for the board. They've got a lot of hard decisions to make that have to do with how we're going to balance the men and the women. And the only negatives that and I think about this sometimes, particularly in development, I've seen some interesting examples of success. When women leave, their name changes, for one thing. And it's harder, when they marry and go away, and it's harder to track your constituency. That's a challenge. And the other thing is that men have always made the philanthropic gifts.
It's going to be interesting to
see. But
when they start coming.
Some of these young women already are becoming very successful in their own careers.
They sure are.
And are making significant gifts. And I think the fact that this thing that's been instituted through the Alumni Association, where the senior class makes a gift to the university, is going to be enormously helpful in focusing. They leave here knowing that, I imagine the numbers are increasing. And one difference is going to be that they're going to split, the gifts may be smaller, because let's say he went to Davidson, and let's say that she went to Washington and Lee, and they're going to split their gift. It's going to be two gifts.
They're going to have to encourage more romances at Washington and Lee, aren't they? They're going to flip the paper.